very first memory I can trace is when I was about 3 years old, and I saw my the way I found out how old I was with that. The first memory is of my sister Winnie when she was just born. She was lying in bed with my wife, with my mother. This was in this little two-room house in Alberta.
And that's the earliest memory you have.
Yeah.
Huh? Now, then before you went to school, did you live in Alberta before you went to school?
Oh, yes. We lived there till I was seven. And
started school in Alberta?
No. There was something going on which I couldn't understand. Anyway, what it meant was that my parents knew that they were going to move to Manitoba, even when I was only six. So they didn't want me to start school in Alberta. They held me off. And in that way, they also made it so that my brother would go to school with me, and he was a year and 9 months younger than me. So that all through our early school days, my brother and I were always in the same grade, although I was almost 2 years older than him.
I see. And did you find school...
Terrifying.
Terrifying?
Yeah, it was a traumatic experience.
Why was it?
One more thing was that the only two words of English we knew were yes and no. In that district in Alberta, it was an entirely Ukrainian district, and so there was no need to, and also my parents were pretty conscious of being Ukrainian, so that they wanted us to speak Ukrainian all the time, you know, at home. Especially my father. My mother was already born in Alberta, in Canada, so she was more liberal on the subject. My father was even anti-English, so that he had no use for the English. So we didn't learn any Ukrainian, rather English at home, so we started off at almost zero position when we went to school. This was already in a mixed neighborhood, and there was a certain amount of true blue English, what shall we call it?
Attitude.
Feeling.
Yeah.
Attitude. This was also nearing the time of the Second World War, so that we were quite conscious of British, Canada was British. So it was traumatic in that sense, and also it was that we ran into a situation where there was quite a bit of, in a one-room schoolhouse like that, there's a tendency to be bullying and feuding and everything like that, and I was very sensitive to those things, and I ran right into them, and we were the body end of all kinds of pranks, cruel pranks, and tale-telling and everything like that.
And what, do you remember your first teacher?
Yes. We had a reunion at that school about 10 years ago, and I met her, and her name was Miss Irvin, and she was extremely conscientious and hardworking. But my parents used to say that they used to admire her, but they were always used to wonder how long she'd last, because she looked. They kept saying she was tubercular and that she would. She was going to die soon.
I see.
She also kept a strict hand on the school.
Did she ever punish you?
No, we were too timid. We did make a lot of boo-boos as far as our Ukrainian background coming out. But she realized, I think, that we couldn't be blamed for that.
And there were some other children who had a kindly attitude towards you, though, weren't there?
There were a very few. One was a boy, a neighbor's boy, an older boy. He was almost, 2 years from leaving school when I arrived there, and he was kind to me. But he didn't last, he didn't stay long enough for me to... The number of those who were cruel or bullying far outnumbered the ones that had a tendency to. And they, poor fellows, the ones that were had a tendency to be kind couldn't resist, couldn't go too much against the others. They also wanted to be acceptable in the group. So, and as far as the young children, the ones my own age, well, there was no... they were set against us deliberately by their by the older children.
Well, that's not a very happy situation to be in, was it?
No, that was eventually part of my troubles, in which I ended up in a psychiatric hospital. I'm sure part of them stemmed from the school as well as the home situation.
You see, there's living in constant fear, so to speak.
Yes, extremely so. And also, not only fear, but extreme animosity. That I was helpless physically. I was weak physically. And there was even boys of my own age who just disrespected me. And I hated them with all my heart, but I couldn't do anything
about it.
Yes.
Did the teacher ever take your side?
When there was an actual confrontation, and then there were one or two instances when such a situation did arise, and I just couldn't stand it anymore, and we had a fight. Then she was typically. Had the typical British, impartiality, parliamentary, or British justice idea. So I had no complaints on that score from the teacher anyway.
I see. How far do you live from school?
We lived, if you measured it, it probably come to exactly a mile, although we didn't live right on a corner of it. Section.
Well, that wasn't no hardship going to school. Then.
No. There were other children who had to walk as far as 4 miles.
I see. And did your father know that you had a little difficulties to fit in school?
Oh, yes.
Did he do anything about it?
They did, and that made it worse because my mother went with us as the bullying proceeded, and it seemed that part of the, it was kind of a neighborhood resentment against my father's ambitiousness, that they judged, my parents judged, that the neighbors were jealous and that they were taking it out on their children, via their own children. So that my mother went with us finally to school and she complained to the teacher. And that made it worse because the teacher said, there must be no more bullying of the Kralik boys. And so the bullies were in control of the situation. They sort of had everybody listening to them. They forbade anybody to have anything to do with us.
You sort of ostracized.
Ostracized, yes. Yeah, but then my brother was sent home that particular spring. I went both for 3 months to school. My brother was sent home because he was too young. And I did part of first grade just to get me used to school. And in that time, that was the worst. I didn't even have my brother for company, so that I really suffered then by being ostracized. And the Ukrainian children, there were quite a few Ukrainian children, they wouldn't... they would play quite... amicably with us when we went to visit them at their neighbors or at our own home, but when we got to school, they just shunned us altogether because they were afraid of what the other, the bigger, the bullies would say.
So that had a traumatic effect on the young child at school.
Yeah.
Now, how long did this last? Were you able to overcome this situation?
Well, we tried, my brother and I tried fighting, you know, fighting back. And it was hopeless because the harder we fought, the more joined in, the more, if we seemed to be holding our own, then they sent more and more people against us. So that we saw it was hopeless trying to fight. So the only thing we could do was to wait, just bide our time until the people either moved from the district or they grew up so that they had to leave school. So that in about 2 or 3 years, most of the big bullies had graduated, they had left school. So then we were left with our rivals on our own age. And this continued with one or two particular boys. That one was Ukrainian, and one was of American origin. So this rivalry continued till about grade 8. Only in the last grade, in grade 9, that we finally got out of that continual round of hostility.
Now, as an artist, did you display any artistic ambition, or were you able to fulfill yourself creatively in school?
Well, there was always art one period a week. I think it was Friday afternoon that we had art. Also, I noticed fairly early that I could draw. I had some ability at drawing. And I had a rivalry with a Mennonite boy in schoolwork. And he also maintained that he could draw better than me, so we had a competition between ourselves. Nature, not... We were serious about our competition. But we weren't competing in... We competed only with words, not with... physically. So that was how I realized that, because I it seemed to be plain that I could draw better than him, so there was nobody else. So but I lacked respect from any other source except my schoolwork. I tended to draw more and more so that way I get the respect of the other pupils and the teacher. The teacher used to give us me extra little things to do, which also boosted my morale. And then there was also every probably inspector, school inspector, you know, that there were holidays like Halloween, Valentine's,
yes.
Christmas. All those things called for artwork. So I would always compete myself in a sense that I would try to see if I can draw a better witch or pumpkin or Valentine this year than last year. So that's how my I developed artistically. I used to draw only things like boys do. They draw cowboys and guns and airplanes and pirates.
Hmm. You mentioned inspectors. Do you remember any inspector coming to your school?
Yeah, that was always an event for us. I don't remember who he was. But he came once a year. Something like the dairy inspector used to come once. We'd always whitewash the barn before when we heard in the neighborhood that he was going to appear.
I see. Now, you say dairy inspector. Did your father, besides sowing grain, have a big herd of cattle?
Selling grain?
Yeah. Well, he wasn't only a grain farmer. He had mixed farming, did he?
Well, he came from Alberta, where he was entirely a grain farmer, with the ambition to become a wheat king, so to speak, in his this district too, but it didn't work out because the land wasn't suitable. And all, everybody else was dairy farming, so he thought he could prove that he would succeed. And we, but it was a bad time to prove anything because of the depression. And also there were crop failures and grasshoppers and drought and rust and everything else. So eventually he was forced to half concede defeat, and he went into dairy too. And that was really a wise step. From there we were able to pull ourselves out of the big mortgage situation we were in.
Mm-hmm. But tell me, when you lived on a farm, did you ever experience want, or did you? There was no poverty on the farm.
There was. I didn't know that we were living in a depression, but I found out later when we went to school in Winnipeg. But just for an example, the neighbors used to, for Christmas presents, the lady used to give woolen mittens. I hated those kind of practical presents, but used to get these woolen mittens, and they used to get, could she knit herself, and then they would get washed, and then they would shrink so that they were about up to there on my hand. But we still had to wear them. And we were playing in a hayloft, I remember once, and I lost one of those mittens, and I would have been glad to part with it, but my parents insisted that I had to find it, and they sent me for 3 days. I sought for that mitten for 3 days before I found it.
Oh, that was a little bit hard, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, it was an example. Like today, my kids lose a mitten. Well, we might say something to them by way of reprimand, but then we don't bother searching for it. We just go and get another pair.
Yes. Excuse me. Now, what work did you like to do on the farm?
Is it going?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I didn't like any work. Because my father was always down on me for not being the type of smart. The word, I guess the word that would cover all those things would be smart. And it's in a proper meaning of the sense, in the proper sense of the word smart.
What Ukrainian word would you say?
Is djibne or tsikave. My father used those two words. Djibne, nes djibne, nes tsikave. That he's always criticizing me.
See? He thought he weren't interested in the farm life.
No, tsikave.
Or active, right?
Meaning that you're interested in everything.
That's right.
Not that you were, I wasn't interested in specifically farm work, but just wanted me to be bright.
Mm-hmm.
Or smart.
But you, while you live on the farm, you...
I had to.
You drive horses and...
Yes, I had to do all those things.
Milk cows.
Yeah.
And drive a tractor.
Everything, yeah. Although I did, as he says in a film that was made about me, that I tried to avoid things. Like if I could get out driving a tractor or driving a team of horses, I would. Like somebody else would take it from me. But... there were situations when I just had to do what I hated doing, what I feared doing, I had to do anyway. And in looking back on it now, I'm glad I did. But just a pity that it had to be that way, because I could have, if the sake only from my art, if I'd been what my father wanted me to be, that means tsikave, I would have been interested and tried many more things and gone many more places. And like if I'd been more sociable, he was down on me very hard for being shy and backward and everything. If I'd been more active socially, I would today have a bigger store of ideas from my farm paintings.
Well, how about your brother? Was he the same temperament as you?
No. He was lucky. God gave him the talent in engineering, and he definitely has a talent. He's now a chief engineer in a big company, and he invents machines, so that But the thing is that on a farm, his talent came was completely in line with my father's desires. And he was also, although he was 2 years younger than me, he was, what my father always pointed out, that he was brighter than me. That he, if a horse lost a collar, for example, or a halter, he would find it. And I didn't, you know, and my father would praise him, and it hurt me. That there was nothing I could do that would impress my father, whereas my brother could.
Would your mother take your sides at any time?
She did sometimes when my father was down on us children as a group, as far as I can remember. But she also was after me, and in her own way, she tended to nag, so that one of the things that bothered my dad a lot about me, and this is one thing that she also went after me about, was this, that I was always dumb. They call it nyume. Oh, I dreaded saying anything so that they wouldn't notice me. And they would continually nag me about not talking.
Well, that's interesting. That's typically Ukrainian. They want you to speak out, and what's the matter with you? You know, not doing the rest of it. They didn't respect sensitivity, I imagine. Mm-hmm. All right, then. You did spend your, now in your home, as far as food is concerned, was there any food you didn't like?
Was there what?
Food.
Anything? Food?
Yes.
Oh, I hated porridge.
Yes.
I had to eat it. Apart from that, I was finicky about certain things that could have been better, what I thought could be better. Like, for example, when we made lunch for our day to school, with too much bread, too much butter between the bread, that sort of. In Ukrainian, I use the word "mlayite."
Oh, yes.
Things like that, you know. That, and I also envied the poorer and neighbors' children that whom my parents tend to look down on. Because they had some more exciting things like brown sugar in the bread.
I see.
We had always this choked cherry jam and saskatoon jam, and sometimes we bought a tin of strawberry jam from the store, and the French mustard we had. But I liked bologna. Of all of the various meats we had, but I did acquire a good taste for Ukrainian food. So that even today, I sort of regret that I didn't marry a Ukrainian woman, so that I could still have those things. I love sour foods like sauerkraut. And,
of course, you can. Can't you buy them in the stores in Toronto?
Oh yes, but then I would be eating them by myself in the family,
yes.
And my children have no taste for those things either. So
how many children have you got?
I have 4 children.
Let's see.
Ranging from 7 to 11 years old.
Any of them artistic?
Well, this may seem rather odd to you. We have. Of those 4 children, one is adopted, and she seems to have the most talent.
Well, that's normal.
Well, no, but most people ask me that same question, fully expecting me to say that one of them has taken after me.
Not necessarily, no. They could probably be taking after your dad and be practical, very practical in their approach to life. Now, let's get back to the interesting story you're telling me. Mr. Willock. So, what did you like most about farm life?
Oh, I really fell in love with nature. And although my father was very ambitious and so worked so hard and called himself and us that often we weren't able to appreciate nature as much as our neighbors' children because they were more leisurely, it still got some of that got through. So that I was really taken by nature. And I like birds, I like to explore, take the measure of water in the spring with my rubber boots. And I like natural sports like archery or... I loved the big displays of nature like storms and blizzards and all those things like that.
Well, that was the influence of nature in the farm, and you like to go for a walk. And do you have any woodlands in the bush around?
What Manitoba bush is like, it's just more or less scrawny,
yes.
Poplars and oaks.
That's right.
Willows, willow, redwood, red dogwood, willows. But there was, to this day, I'm thankful that there was this area to the east of our farm, immediately to the east of our farm, which is called a bog. And there was nobody living for about 20 miles. Across the bog, there was Selkirk. But between Stonewall and South, but there was nobody, and it was wild, and there was no fences. And we used to love going out there whenever we could get away from farm work.
It always what you still had to help on the farm.
Yeah.
You had the impressions of the of nature, and you felt. You were overcoming your shyness a little bit, were you not, by the time you came to Winnipeg?
Oh, no. Oh, unfortunately, it got worse.
It got worse.
Especially since I was reaching the age of puberty, and I, girls made more, I became much more aware of my backwardness in girls. That required another, that entered another big, heartache, and also is expected to do things like dancing, which I hated, and also the fact that I was felt completely countryish. What the city boys teased us about was that we had hayseeds in our hair. But I felt worse about it. And the only breakthrough in that sense was that we were sent to Ukrainian night school, and I got the respect and admiration of Tas Mayoski, who was our teacher in Ukrainian night school.
And that helped you?
Yes, he became. A father substitute for me, because I could never approach my own father. I was terrified of him. But this man, although there was a lot of language barrier, like he was a priest from the old country, so he used the purest Ukrainian, literary kind of Ukrainian. I couldn't talk to him about a lot of personal things, but still, just to be appreciated the way he appreciated me was real tonic.
Well, that's very interesting. Therefore, a clergyman has to go ahead and do a little more with the young growing boys and young people that need help in adjustment and problems, I guess. It helps. Somebody from outside must help at times. Mm-hmm. Well, that's pretty good. Now, who do you remember as your favorite teachers in Isaac Newton?
Well, do you know any of the teachers there? Do you know?
Yeah, I did know some of them.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
Well, The favorite one, my favorite one was Mr. Armstrong, the history teacher.
Yes, I knew him. He's dead.
Yeah, I know that.
Yes.
Then some of the others I sort of feared but liked at the same time. Like, for example, Mr. Klassen.
Yes,
he was a German teacher. He was a Mennonite origin. Yes. Interestingly enough, he's moved to Ontario, and I met him recently. He came to my place. We renewed acquaintances. He was also an art teacher, as well as a German and PT teacher. And so he had some influence on my development as an artist. Now I don't know that there's any other teacher that I really was fond of. There were some I regret to say today that I actually despised. They were the ones that were rote type teacher. I felt that I had this feeling that they shouldn't have been teachers in the first place, that they just did it to get a secure position, and they didn't really love to teach, but they were in it, and they repeated the same thing every year to the same, everything is repeated, this other classes were exactly the same.
Now happened to know quite a few of those teachers from Isaac Newton, because most of them moved over to Sisler afterwards, so I knew them. And then I was going to ask you this matter of curricular selection in high school. You know, we formed a curriculum in Manitoba, I was on it, and we tried to say that the student should have a chance to develop his own course, or say that this is what he would like to follow on his own. What do you think of that?
I would agree in part. I think there are certain subjects that the student at that age is not competent in, is not competent to know what's good for him. So there should be a certain amount, I would say there should be a certain amount of freedom to select, and then the rest should be assigned. So for example, I think the English should be assigned, I think mathematics should be assigned, in high school that is, but once you get to university then you should be completely free.
I see.
And I wasn't.
Let's see, how did you do in high school? You did pretty well in your subjects?
Well, I did quite well the first year. We were put in a room which the teachers thought we fitted in intellectually. And it turned out that we were backward because we were from the country, but we caught up and passed everybody. The only thing is that then they swung over to the opposite extreme, and they sent me into a room for the second year, grade 11, they sent me into a room that was the cream of the crop in Isaac Newton. And that was fatal, because my only sources of self-respect for many years had been my high marks in school. Like I always used to get 90 averages at public school. And here I just couldn't keep up, I couldn't measure up to those, the bright students. So I collapsed in the sense that I just couldn't study anymore. I just didn't have any incentive to study, so I failed. Right from being top of the class, I went down to failure, and that was a real big blow to me.
How would your father react to it?
Well, fortunately, I failed an Easter exam,
so
it was still a departmental exam in June that I could write, and I did, and I passed.
Oh, that's it.
But another humiliation to me was that my brother, who was always behind me, was we didn't have to write the departmental exam.
Oh,
I did.
I see.
So I really, really became fanatical after that. I said, nobody cares. If you lose, nobody cares. So I took the Churchillian motto that nothing matters now but victory. And I overstudied in grade 12.
And you succeeded?
Yeah, I pulled myself into, I think, second or third place in class. But I overstudied and I got eye trouble.
I see.
And I also actually passed out once. And, like, just fainted when I was studying.
Mm-hmm. And so then you got your grade 12. And what year would that be? What year did you get your grade 12?
Well, I can't remember. It was, I think it was 46 or 45. I know that the war ended.
It'd be 45.
See, now, if I graduated from university in 49, I was at university for 3 years. That means that I must have graduated from Isaac Newton when I was in 46.
I see. And then you went to university and you found university challenging, but you found your problems of adjustment too, social adjustment.
Oh, yes, very much. The thing is that I was becoming intellectually proud. That's when I went over from agnosticism to complete atheism. But so that I had a certain pride in being in university, but I was very backward socially. I'm terribly afraid of opening my mouth and being heard anytime in anything. Also, my father had in high school, he had forced me to make a decision to be a doctor, and so I had dropped German and had caught up on my Latin. There was no Latin in the country school, so I had to go to summer school and get 3 years of Latin in 6 weeks. And so then I went into university, promising my father I would be a teacher instead. So that he kept supporting me. And then I took, because oddly enough, even though I had hated taking Latin, because Latin was required for going into medicine, I found out that I liked Latin. It was challenging in the sense that it was like doing jigsaw puzzles. It's a very sparse language. And so I majored in Latin. I took history, English, and Latin. So, and it was in the Latin class that I socially felt very ill at ease.
And so after you did tell me your university life, you said socially ill at ease. It wasn't due to dress.
Yes, it was.
It was, eh?
Well, everything. I just felt that everybody despised me or sort of...
You didn't have...
The way my posture, everything that I felt was that they were looking down on me about.
And how did you go to university? By streetcar or by bus?
There was this Fort Garry bus. First of all, when I started university, I went to Broadway.
That was
before Broadway was torn down. And there I went as long as I could before winter and ice and snow made it impossible. I went by bike from our house on Burroughs Avenue. And I remember I hated taking money from my father because he always kept emphasizing that I was a worthy enough son for him. So I I hated taking money from him, so I tried avoiding getting any expensive clothing. So I remember this time riding to school, university on a bike, and I had bought this cheapest possible jacket, and the dye was fast in it, and it rained, and I got arrived at university and took it off, and my shirt was all brown from the dye had gone right through the jacket into my shirt.
One thing adds to another. That didn't help, did it?
Mm.
Well, would there be anybody who would be show interest in you at the university?
I did fairly well in Latin. Professor Hugo and Barry were kind to me. Professor Johnson was much more remote to me, and I felt ill at ease, quite ill at ease with him. But the trouble was that there was so. This was the time that all the veterans had come back, and the classes were swollen. They were some of the classes were so big they had to be held in amphitheaters, and it was just impossible for any of the lectures to have any close contact with the students unless they were what my father would. Used to say Sikavi or Chamie. They would approach the lecture and after class or in between class, and they would sort of talk with them. That I didn't dare do.
Mm-hmm. And do you remember the first dance you went to?
I went to dances out in the country. There was one that we went north. I don't know whether it was as far as Camarno, or we went as far as the Scandinavian district, north of Balmoral somewhere. And that was a pleasant experience, because my cousin Bela Bujak was a very natural musician. He would play. He played for the dance only in his accordion, and I really loved his music. But I always had this problem of people badgering me to dance, you know, to get up and dance, and I hated it, and I didn't want to, and I just froze, completely froze. So, and then there was the first time I ever rebelled against my parents was one such occasion. They said I had to go to dance in Stonewall, to the town hall dance on New Year's Day. I rebelled and said I wouldn't go. They almost evicted me. I was really surprised. Like I was very slow developing, and I rebelled against my parents much later than my brother, who was younger than me.
But he could rebel and get away with it. And
yes, I couldn't believe my eyes, and I saw him answering my father back. They were working under the veranda, I remember that time, repairing the veranda. He answered my father back, and my father just stared at him. He didn't jump on him. I couldn't believe it. Anyway, then when I really got more and more pressure to be sociable, to be natural, normal. My parents said, they said that all the people were saying that I was sickly. And it was a disgrace to them socially. I was in high school. I remember having a dance or two with my sister, Winnie, who was also attending Isaac Newton by then. Danced one or two dances with her. And the principal, Mr. Floyd, came up and he gave me a scolding that I was so backward socially. And even the people who tried to be kind to me were cruel, because they would say, "Cheer up, Bill. It's not so bad." You know.
Yeah. approach their kindness was they were really butchering you by their expressions, you know. They thought they were friendly to you, and those were the things that hurt, right?
Yeah, well, at that time I blamed everybody, but I realized it. And that when I went to England, to get my depression and my eye pain tended to, I found that the English were very kind to me, and it was a kind of a gentlemanly tolerance that they had, which the Canadians just didn't have. Whether they were Ukrainian or English origin, life was so raw still from the almost pioneer life that they hadn't refined their sensibilities. I think today, if I were growing up as a boy today in Canada, it'd be easier.
And that's an interesting observation. We are changing too. You really had to experience the life of the frontier, so to speak, even in the time you came to Manitoba. And you have been in the world and you've traveled quite a bit. And what country would you like the best?
Well, I like Canada.
Canada, that's right.
But at one time, when I went to England, I very nearly remained there for good. Hadn't been for my conversion, perhaps. Like, I realized then that my bitterness against my parents had been wrong, and that all those people who hurt me, I should have returned good for evil, so to speak. So then I wanted to get back to Canada to help my father, who seemed to have a lot of suffering on the farm, on a small farm he was in Ontario. But otherwise, I would have remained in England for good, because in the 7 years I was there, I had been so much happier than I had been in Canada.
Did you work while you were in England?
Yes, I did two jobs. To keep saving my money, which I had earned in a bush in a lumber camp in Ontario and Quebec, I took a job in between sessions at the hospital. And that was taking up tram lines. London was taking up its tram lines then, putting in only buses. So there, I also ran into some of the same problems I had, social problems, that the laboring type of Englishman didn't... It wasn't so much that I was different, but that I was too honest. There was a tendency among the British laboring classes to try and steal, even though the government they had was a labor government. They tended to cheat by having extra long tea breaks, and they would some of the iron that was taken up from the trams were. Iron was supposed to be set aside so that the London transport would use it for profit, you know. Well, these workers would take that, throw it on the back of the truck, and then they would sell it for themselves. Well, I couldn't stand that, so I wouldn't throw it on the truck. Then they ostracized me for that. But then I had... I returned... one summer to Canada to make some money to go to Holy Land. Then I returned to England for another 2 years. And then I went into picture framing, trade of picture framing. So I started at rock bottom wages with a picture framer in London. So I worked for them for 2 years. That was the longest job I ever held.
You didn't study at all in England, or did you?
I tried. The first time I arrived, the first year, at the same time I went to hospital, I was looking for art schools too. And I even went abroad to the continent, and I went to Vienna and Paris. I visualized myself going to Paris, but then, even though I learned some French in Montreal school, I still didn't feel secure enough in Paris. So I decided to back out and look only for art school in London, England, but wherever I looked, I still couldn't get over this feeling that I had when I was going to Ontario Art College or the school in Mexico, that there was something missing in a scholastic type of art education. So eventually I ended up that I just gave it up and decided just to learn painting by painting.
Well, when you were working as a picture framer, were you painting a bit?
Yes, I was painting then. First of all, the hospital in England had been really good to me as part of my career, in the sense that they took me in and they recognized that I was an artist, and they gave me a special room to paint in, and they gave me material. I didn't have to worry about a thing. I didn't have to worry about selling my paintings or anything, just painted, which is a real boost to my morale. And
well, did your family know that you weren't well?
They didn't. I was so angry with my parents for the misunderstanding me in that I went off without telling them where I was going. I said I was going to England, but I didn't tell them I was going to hospital.
So, did you write to them at any time?
Well, then I planned not to write or have any communication, but oddly enough, as I was in the hospital the first time for a checkup, first 2 months I was in there, my sister Winnie came across with her friend to tour Europe, like hitchhike around. And they went to Canada House, in Trafalgar Square, and they saw my address written in the guest book there, that I had written it down. And I had written the hospital address. For some reason, I don't know why I did it, but immediately my sister jumped to the conclusion that I had an accident. She didn't think of any kind of other hospital except physical ailment.
Yeah.
So they came to the hospital, and she was crying when she came. And when she saw that I was walking around, apparently hale and hearty, she said, "Oh, is that all it is? So then, of course, she either wrote or told when she went back to Canada that I wasn't in the hospital. But I didn't correspond with my parents about it.
When you corresponded with your parents, you wrote letters. What language did you use? If you ever wrote a letter.
This might be interesting. I wrote to my mother always in English and my father in Ukrainian always.
I see.
Because that's the language I felt that they were the best communication could be.
That's very
my
good.
Ukrainian was weak, and the things I wanted to tell my father, so I used the Ukrainian dictionary, Ukrainian English dictionary, and I'm sure some of the words I used were wrong, but this is the best I could do.
Yes, but you were at least you really honored your father by doing that, didn't you? You would write to him in the language that he would understand, correct? And that is admirable.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. And so when you came back to Canada, when was your first picture success? First picture brought you success?
Isaac's gallery, that's Mr. Avram Isaac's gallery in Toronto. He was just starting out then himself, and he'd been in business for about 2 or 3 years. And I went around to various galleries with my sample of my frames. I was looking for framing work. I also took my paintings along, and nobody saw any promise in them. It had been the same somewhat in England when I went to galleries, that nobody seemed to. But anyway, he I went to him finally looking for picture frame work, and he got interested in the paintings that were in the frames that I was showing. And he said, I'd like to give you a show. This was about a month after I came back. And
who was this gentleman again, please?
Avram Isaacs.
Oh, yes.
He was his Jewish origin, originally from Winnipeg. But then the family had moved to Toronto.
Yes.
And he had taken a course in economics at the University in Toronto, and then he went into business as a picture framer and a gallery owner. So he gave me my first one-man show, and it was an immediate success. Plus the fact that the Jewish Women's Organization also helped a lot by giving me two openings, and they bought a lot of my paintings, that it was a real big boost morale-wise for me.
Now that was your start. And then when was the first book you written?
I didn't. Another similar situation developed. A lady of English origin, May Cutler in Montreal. She's a small but very high quality Canadian publisher. She approached me when I had a show in Montreal. And asked me if I would be interested in doing a book, a children's book. So, once again, she perceived something which nobody else could see, not even Mr. Isaacs all that much. So she asked me to do a series on winter in Canada, and I did a thing called Prairie Boys Winter. And she dealt. For a long time, she was having great financial difficulties. She couldn't get Canada Council to support her. So finally, she went to American publisher, and they helped her out. Houghton Mifflin in Boston. So they produced jointly Prairie Boys Winter. Once the book came out, then it was like another big breakthrough. Immediately, it became popular. Even at one point, I think Canada, it was a bestseller, Canadian nonfiction. Just for a week or so, it was in the top, among the top 10. So then everybody started to get interested in possibilities of me doing more books. So it's been uphill ever since. Since then, I have another publisher is after me, and another two publishers. So that I keep on producing. Like this thing I'm working on right now is going to be a book.
And then I want to go back to England. You mentioned Margaret Smith. Tell me about her.
Well, she was the angel that God sent that finally broke through my shell. That nobody had always needed and wanted a friend that could come close to me. And she was an occupational therapist at the hospital. She taught me dancing, tried to help me get out of the shell by teaching me dancing. And she also brought material for me to work with. She didn't know all that much about art, but she at least brought, she recognized that fact, and so she just helped me out by bringing me materials and asking me questions about the paintings. But the thing that really did the trick as far as her help were that the doctors were kind in a clinical sort of way. They did what they had to do. But she did more. She gave some of her own time after hours when she wasn't expected to. And that really made a big impression on me. So she would come every once a day. She would come after work and talk with me for an hour, whatever I wanted to talk about. And I found myself confiding in her, no matter how intimate details are described to the doctors, you know, like their psychiatrists, they tell everything, no matter what's on your mind, even the most embarrassing things. With her, I could talk and feel that there was, it's almost like she became a second mother to me. And she was 10 years older than me.
Yes.
And then gradually, by fluke, we found out that we both liked poetry. So she brought me a book of her poems, an anthology of poems, and I found it was wrapped in a Catholic newspaper at the cover, you know, dust jacket.
Yes.
So I then it dawned on me that, was she a Catholic? I thought, well, so I asked her, and she said, yes, I am. So then, at that time, I was a practicing atheist. I was trying to get other people to give up their faith, whatever they had. There was, I remember one Jewish patient in the hospital I was trying to convert to atheism. But I admired her. So, although I made fun of her beliefs at times, I still had to admit I was interested in finding out what made her tick. Why did she help me when nobody else would, in a special way? So, bit by bit, I began to get curious about what she believed in, so I began to ask her questions. She couldn't, some of them she could answer herself, some she couldn't, so she used to bring pamphlets she would find on the subject. In that way, I got more and more, better and better knowledge of Catholic or Christian faith. And she stuck with me, you know, right to the, until I went right through hospital, which is about 2.5 years, until she saw that I could stand on my own feet.
Where's Margaret Smith now?
She's in England. She's retired now. About 2 years, a year or two ago, she retired from occupational therapy. So she's living in she has a cottage in the country in Wiltshire.
Do you keep in touch with her?
Yeah, but not at any great length. I write to her about 2 or 3 times a year.
That's very formalistic. That's very good. And then you came into Canada and the success. Where did you meet your wife?
It was at the Catholic Information Center in Toronto. I didn't notice her at first, you know, even though she went with the Catholic Information Center. The whole group, there were about 50 people, went to a picnic at my dad's farm one time, like a wiener roast at night. And she was in that group, and I didn't even see her. But then there was a group formed, a Legion of Mary group at the center that were looking, set out to help prostitutes and drug addicts. They tried to go out in the street and try to convince them to give up their ways. And that's when I noticed her standing in the hall before she went into the meetings, Legion of Mary meetings. So then there was a dance. There was a dance at the center too one time. So she was at the dance, so I asked her for a dance. And after all those many years when I used to hate dancing, and I said, I always visualized myself as meeting my wife in any other circumstance but ordinary dance. It ended up that I did meet my wife at a dance.
You did. Well, that's fine. And you have 4 children,
mm-hmm.
and you're living in Toronto.
Mm-hmm.
And how do your children look at your art?
They don't say much, you know. They're not. They seem to be sort of. At the beginning, when they were really small, then they used to come and sit on the steps of my studio, which is down in the basement of my home, and they would ask for cardboard and magic markers, and they would draw with me. They would draw things while I was working. But now they've got, went off into interests of their own, so they don't. It was a rather amusing thing at school. One of my adopted girl's classmates, her father is an artist, so that girl came to school and told Barbara that she, her father was a better artist than me. So that was a source of amusement in our family.
Well, now that your children will have a chance to grow, and they're doing well at school.
The girls are. The boys are sort of hanging in there.
I see. Do you spend much time with them?
I don't know whether it was you I told. No, it was the other interviewer that was at the alumni office.
Yes.
What's his, her name? Anne somebody or other.
Yes.
She interviewed me.
The girl that was, yes, I think I know. Her father writes books, is that right?
A lady.
Yes, Lynn McFarlane, is it?
I don't know. I can't remember now.
Well.
Anyway, she asked me the same question. There is a barrier between my wife and me on the raising of the children, so that I've had to, in order to save the family from, it takes two to tangle.
Yes.
So to save the family from some of the same bad atmosphere that we had at home, you know, there's always hostility. I've tended to withdraw, so that although I play with my children and I friendly with them and I show them affection, you know, but as far as actual raising of them, you know, the guiding them toward any, I find it is better to wait in a hope that someday my wife will allow me take more part in their raising, in their, because our philosophy is opposed in diametrically in some cases on the way to raise children or the way to live or anything like that, you know.
Mm-hmm. Does she tend to be fairly more formalistic, is that right?
No, it's not that. I have this intuition of hard times to come, and I feel that she's overprotecting the children, that she's, you know, and that to face hardships in life, even though we don't have no need to be face hardships, we can still do without things. And you know, like for example, I fast. I think that fasting is a good thing, but it's she regards it with horror. You know.
Well, she's a practicing Catholic.
Oh yeah, oh yeah. In that sense, that they get all the formal things.
Yeah.
But not. I feel there's that barrier that that I feel that there's hard times coming for Christians. And in that sense, I would have our children learn some of the old-fashioned Christian virtues.
I see. All right. Now, how do your children react to the fact they know that you're of Ukrainian extraction? How do they accept this? Do they ask questions?
No, I tried to teach them Ukrainian.
You do?
I tried. Mm-hmm. For several years I was teaching them. But they regarded it as a chore. Mm-hmm. First of all, my wife said she would learn, but she tried it a few months and then backed out. And as long as I find that the mother has the most influence on children, language-wise and culture-wise, I feel I'm bucking a stream, you know. So they just sort of, I guess no, this, I have the same feeling as about my art, at least, that they express no interest. They don't, they're not against it, but on the other hand, they don't participate.
They don't understand. They just don't participate.
No, don't participate. Yeah.
I see. And you yourself, what do you feel is the future of people of Ukrainian extraction in Canada?
Well, I feel it eventually will be melting apart or catch up to us. But I feel that we should, if there's any desire in us to hold on to it, then we should, until it's no longer we feel it's no longer natural to do so. But any desire, like I have a desire. I love Ukrainian music. I buy Ukrainian records and I play them while I'm working. It really, speaks to me. So that, I, in that sense, I want to hold on to it.
You get that reaction from Ukrainian music. You get that reaction from Ukrainian poetry. Do you still like reading Shevchenko's poetry?
Well, no. I like hearing it, but the latest thing I was touched by was reading of Stefanik's Stone Cross.
Yeah, the Kamenny Krest.
Yeah, it was really a moving thing. It was I was introduced to it by family in Thunder Bay when I had a show there. And I illustrated recently Les Maqueta with 72 drawings, which is going to be the first English translation of Les Maqueta. So that I got a little bit acquainted with Fern Thorpe's poetry. And I used to read Kobzar, and I was quite moved by Shevchenko's ability as a poet. The only thing that bothered me about him was this two things, was this feeling of lamentation. There's that lamentation running through his work, which bothered me a bit, and also his those elements of anti-Semitism and anti-Catholicism, which was common in Russia at that time. So I can quite understand it, like in the same way that Gogol was also imbibed that from the world. It was common in greater Russia at that time.
Well, you knew that Gogol was Ukrainian.
Oh, yes, I know that.
Yeah. And you like Ukrainian poetry and literature and
food
and
music.
You know, you're really having a normal transition as a Canadian who doesn't run away from his background.
No, my gallery and studio at my own home is all decorated in hand painted Ukrainian designs. It's like a peasant, Queen Peasant's house. If you want.
Well, that's very admirable, because I do think you can't just. I don't think anybody expects you, Canadian citizens, to run away from the fact that you are, and you have been able to succeed with your name being Kirillic, and you don't believe in changing it, do you?
No, I regard it with horror.
And. So there we are in the transition state, and now you know we here in Manitoba, the youngsters have an opportunity to study Ukrainian now in the high schools. What do you think of it?
Well, that's a good idea. I'm sorry it wasn't around when I was going to school.
And you think that any person that has a chance should go ahead and do it. I want your reaction to this situation. Do you think that we should provide those who do not know the Ukrainian language a little more material in English?
How do you mean?
Well, about Ukrainians.
Oh, sure. Any source of information about one's roots are valuable and good yeah. thing, sure.
Have you made any studies of Shevchenko's art?
Oh, yes. Well, I was in Ukraine and I saw his art in the flesh, so to speak. I saw the real things.
Yes.
And I studied his books of his. There was a volumes, I think three books all in one composite volume that was lent to me for several years, which I studied it. I think he was a good painter or a draftsman, he wasn't as good as graphic art as he is a poet.
He was.
That's my
impression.
Private judgment.
Yes. Who do you consider to be the greatest Ukrainian artist in the work similar to what you do?
Oh well, right now there's Nizdovsky in New York. When we were in the Ukraine,
yes.
We saw quite a lot. The only trouble is I didn't remember all their names. The only one that really sticks in my mind is Repin. His work I really admire.
And now you are really, so to speak, a Canadian artist.
Oh yeah. Yes.
You're a Canadian artist in the true sense, and you know the Canadian scene. You really believe in the Canadian scene.
Mm-hmm.
What part of Canada would you like to concentrate most? Or hey, you are not establishing prejudice.
Oh well, I have a tendency to branch out and become an all Canadian artist.
Yes.
To that extent, I've traveled right across the country and tried staying in various provinces. I just follow the trend, whatever the public seems to want. I've been up in the Arctic once already, and I've done a series of paintings of the Arctic. Now I'm being asked by another publisher to go up there in October and do some more research on the actual Eskimos. So I'll be going in October, and we'll be doing another book just on the Arctic itself.
Do you know Tilenius?
Who?
Clarence Tilenius.
No.
You have never met him. Mm-hmm. Well, do you know? Well, Clarence is older than you are, and Clarence, you were speaking about the Swedish district out there around Inwood. Clarence Tilenius grew up in that area around north of Tulon, northeast,
mm-hmm.
northwest of Tulon. He is concentrating on animal art, drawing here in Manitoba.
Mm-hmm.
Have you met Mr. Moll?
Yeah, yeah. I think he's a great artist. I have no reservations about
Leo.
Leo as an artist, as a great artist.
And you would encourage people, not only of Ukrainian extraction, but any child who has a talent or bent for art to develop it, would you not?
Oh, sure. On the other hand, I'm against, for obvious reasons, against forcing children to take something which they don't want to. Like, say, for example, my youngest son is, often says he's going to be a garbage man. Well, I would agree to that too. If he's happy doing it, and as long as the important thing is how good whether a person is good or how moral he is, not what he does, but how well he does what he likes to do. So,
all right.
But he's changing his mind, so I guess he won't be, but...
May I ask you a question in Ukrainian?
Yeah.
Чому нема одної красої корови?
Прошу?
Чому нема одної красої корови?
Красої? Що це є красою?
Краса чорної, червоної, білої,
і так далі. Тому що це називається shorthorns. Голстін їх доїть на молоко. Це ці всі ті ковбої є, то все на біф, на м'ясо.
А чи у вашій околиці, коли Stonewall, не було Ayrshires, що мають червоні...
О, так, були, так. Я не знаю, що там... у той час це зовсім ніхто не плодив худобу, лише на м'ясо. Все було на молоко туди.
Скажіть мені, чи ви маєте контакт з українцями в... Торонто?
Торонто?
Так, українці без.
О, так, о, я. Маю кілька приятелів. Головно, ми ж з китайцями, ми ж нову прибули.
Добре. Добре. Отже, ви в дійсності маєте широкий контакт з людьми і так далі, і маєте велику сатисфакцію з роботи, що ви робите, так?
Так.
Ви б радили українським молодим людям, щоб вони не залишали української культури? Щоб
так, це довго, як вони природно годи триматися, то добре, триматися.
Have you noticed that there is a change of attitude towards the Ukrainian people in Canada?
Since, I don't mean, over the years?
Since, yeah, so
oh, yeah, there's...
It's a much healthier and nicer feeling.
Yeah.
And that's the way it should be. Mm-hmm. And that's the way it should be.
But on the other hand, I don't believe in being anti-English. And, I feel that the British had a lot of qualities which made it possible for us to find freedom and justice and opportunity here in Canada. Which
well, I'm writing history of the Interlake area, you know, mm-hmm. All the way from Stonewall down, mm-hmm. and I hope to publish mine in English someday, and I hope you'll have a chance to read it. Now, I may... have an opportunity to put in. You were in municipality Rockwood, weren't you?
Yeah, is that Interlake?
That part of it. That's the way the Ukrainians went into the Interlake area. So I hope that if I have the health and the stamina, that I will be able to include William Kirilluk as one of the people in along the ridge that went north, who developed himself into a great artist and of taste and beauty, and I really want to tell you, Mr. Kirilluk, I hope you don't object to or consider this an intrusion, but I've been very captivated with your art. This is probably the greatest artistic experience I've had. So much so that I see an artist at work. How would you describe your art? Tell me.
Well, if you're talking about media or medium,
yes,
I call it mixed. Because as you see, I use a ballpoint pen, I use colored pencils, I use oils, lacquers, pencil, whatever works. I scratch with the knife, exacto knife.
Well, that's what my wife, Mrs. Juwanchak, says, well, now, how does he paint now? And that's the question she asks.
Well, what you're watching right now is not... The basic painting I've done, like this, all this today, this is done today, is primarily painting.
I see.
With the brush. But I'm finishing off now, so.
Good. Now, I want this for the record. I want you to correct me if I'm wrong, if I didn't read you right. You say that your paintings or your art is of two types, socio-religious.
Socio-religious comment.
Socio-religious
comment.
Yes, that's one.
That's one.
And the second is?
Well, I call it simply farm painting, but it could be more broadly expressed by saying it's nostalgic. Nostalgia.
For the life that you maybe hated at one time, and
yeah,
now you can...
Although, not necessarily, because part of that nostalgia is for the bush. I had at least a year of experience in the bush, and I painted that subject too, and I like the bush.
You never spent much... Well, you did... have you painted, drawn a thrashing machine, or did they use thrashing machines?
Oh, yeah, many times. Oh, yeah. As a matter of fact, my father's finished using his thrashing machine. I'm going to take it from him, haul it out to my farm up north in northern Ontario, a small farm. I'm going to keep it there for a souvenir.
You have a farm?
Yes, a small farm.
Whereabouts?
It's north of Bancroft, Ontario, and it's mostly bush and swamp, but it's a lovely place to retreat to. Partly when I'm painting or when a family wants to go for summer holiday.
Yeah. And so you have a nostalgia. Do you like horses?
Yes, I was fond of horses. When we had them on the farm, I didn't like driving them, and I had some runaways with them, which was a very bad experience, but I felt sort of kinship with them, somewhat the same as with the dog, the farm dog. The only thing is that I also like some of the other animals too.
You say you do a lot of art that takes in Manitoba, don't you? You have.
Oh yes. Well, the odd thing is that they say that that the most the deepest imprint on a person's development is made in the first 7 years. Well, oddly enough, that's the exact age at which I moved from Alberta to Manitoba, and yet art-wise, the biggest imprint on my visual memory and also of interest is the Manitoba years at Stonewall. I cannot explain it, but
And how far were you from Stonewall?
Well, we were 5 miles, like 3 miles east and then 2 miles north of Stonewall.
So when I drive to Fraser Wood, I would be able to see your farm on the right.
Yes, but I was out there the other day. The last building that was really standing up was a milk house, which had walls about 2 feet thick out of stone. And even that is coming down. I noticed this year that the roof has fallen off it. So that's the last vestige of the old farm. It's really sad seeing it, but it can't stop. It's not the wheels of time, I guess.
You'd have loved to have had to be able to get to the farm if you... You would have wanted to have had it remain as it was.
Yeah, well, if somebody else had preserved it as it was, fine. But I myself don't feel involved in it enough to actually try to do something about it.
Tell me what you like best.
What do you mean?
In life, what do you like best in art? In life.
Well, I guess God.
What is it?
God.
You do, right?
Yeah. And then the talent he gave me, my art.